What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
Our guest today is Alec Karakassanis. Karakassanis is a civil rights lawyer and the founder of Civil Rights Corps, an organization challenging systemic injustices in the legal system. The organization's work has freed hundreds of thousands of people from illegal jailing and reunited hundreds of thousands of families. He was named the 2016 Trial Lawyer of the Year by Public Justice for designing and litigating constitutional challenges to cash bail and modern debtors' prisons across the United States. He lives in Washington, D.C. His book that we're discussing today is Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Justice System. Welcome back to the show, Alec.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to talk to you again. Alec, so for any of my guests these days that live or traffic in the D.C. area, one of the questions that I think it's important that we enshrine these times in as many ways as possible. Talk about what it has been like since Donald Trump flooded the D.C. area with federal agents of all stripes, and talk about it through the lens of your work, right? Like you stand in the gap for the most marginalized, most criminalized, most prosecuted, most oppressed folks that are caught up in the criminal legal system's webs.
I think it's really important to take a step back before we get into what Trump is doing in particular, which is in many respects alarming and quite dangerous, obviously. But to sort of set the table with what our society looks like in general and what it has looked like for the last several decades. So the United States puts human beings in cages at rates that are unprecedented in the recorded history of the modern world. It also surveils its own population at rates that are unprecedented. So, for example, if you take the typical other country in the world that is of comparable wealth to the United States jails and imprisons people about six times more than those other countries, about 5 to 6 times the steady historical average of even the United States up until about 1980. So for a couple hundred years, it was a pretty steady incarceration rate. It exploded 500 or 600%. Okay, it's not just random. Almost everybody arrested, tracked, surveilled, searched, prosecuted, and eventually jailed and imprisoned is a poor person. And disproportionately, various marginalized communities, particularly obviously Black people. So in the District of Columbia, which you asked about, where I live, for the last couple of decades, the government has jailed Black people at 19 times the rate of white people. Now, overall in this country, District of Columbia is not an outlier. Overall in this country, the United States jails Black people at 6 times the rate of South Africa at the height of apartheid. Okay, this is all pre-Donald Trump type stuff. Okay, so that's the background context. And I could go on and on and on about like how the various forms of surveillance are evolving and increasing the centralized power of the state over people's lives. But I think you get the point. So I think what we've got right now is this situation where, on top of that, Trump is trying to sort of make an overt show of military force in certain cities around the country, including Washington, D.C. And not just military soldiers, but flooding these neighborhoods, as you colorfully put it, with ICE agents. So sort of a new Gestapo, right? People are masked. People are attacking people on the streets with no legal basis, with no recourse, sort of with masks on, with incredible sense of both violence and brutality and impunity. And sort of what we're seeing now, I think, is really an attempt not so much to fundamentally change policing, because as I mentioned, for the most marginalized communities in Washington, D.C., they have been very much living in a police state for a long time. And I've seen that over the last 15 years, starting from when I was a public defender in Washington, D.C. But I think we're seeing an attempt to sort of more forcefully articulate a full-scale rejection of any hope or any sense of shared humanity, shared values, constitutional norms, sort of the idea that we should all try to live together in a project of equality and human flourishing. I think what we're seeing is really an attempt to kind of like in a very open and overt way to sort of reject that and to say that the force and violence of the state weaponized on behalf of a small group of the most powerful, wealthy people in our society is the only thing that matters. And the only thing that matters is who has the guns, who has the money, and everything else is sort of like subject to their whims. That's, I think, the main difference that you see and feel now walking through the streets, watching some of the behavior. It's not that like the number of very vulnerable poor people, marginalized people, immigrants, people of color, you know, being harassed and stopped and arrested and caged is substantially different. It's this kind of like sort of message that's being sent. And then, of course, the complete and utter capitulation, even celebration of that by Democratic Party leaders and media officials is maybe the most disturbing and grotesque part of it.
There's so many places to go. I'm just throwing the script out of the window, and Alec and I are just going to riff for the next half an hour. I mean, one of the things that I do think is important to root people in, though, folks that listen to the show are probably aware, and it's something I bring up when you talk about that the most marginalized folks in D.C. have been living in police state. Remind us, Alec, how many police departments are in D.C.?
It's really depends
not police,
on how
like
you
law
count.
Enforcement agencies. Sorry, broad. Law enforcement agencies. I remember what street it was, but I was on some street. I was walking back from wherever I was going to my hotel, and it was nighttime. And I looked, and I think I identified just on the walk back to my room, like 8 different vehicles.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's so hard to even keep track of them. There's dozens of law enforcement agencies now. As I use the word law enforcement in quotes, obviously, if you read my book, either of my books, Usual Cruelty or Copaganda, you know that I don't like the term law enforcement. I think it's a term of propaganda that police and prosecutors use to sort of convey some kind of like faux objectivity or neutrality. You know, like a law is enforced because a law was broken, you know, and it just naturally follows, when in fact, what these institutions do is they only choose to enforce some laws against some people some of the time in some places, right? And the decisions about against whom we're going to enforce these laws and for what is sort of the entire content of the criminal punishment system. So that's why, for example, there's been decades of violent drug raids in the poorest, predominantly Black neighborhoods, Latina neighborhoods in the United States, and no armed SWAT team drug raids of the Yale or Harvard campuses or Goldman Sachs investment banking parties, et cetera, et cetera. So the police are just constantly just making decisions about whose crimes they're going to look for. And they don't look for wage theft. They don't look for environmental crimes. They look for crimes committed by the very poorest people in our society. But anyway, there are many law enforcement, quote unquote, agencies in DC. Many federal agencies have their own little police forces. Then, of course, there's the big ones, the Metropolitan Police Department, the local DC police, right? And then there's the Capitol Police, which, you know, has multi-hundreds of billions of dollars of budget, and the Democrats voted to expand their budget a couple of years ago, even though they're one of the most unaccountable and incompetent police forces in the area, which is, you know, obviously a low bar. And then there's the Park Police, which is another one of the big ones. But yeah, there's police everywhere. It's an incredibly over-policed city, and I don't like the term over-policing either, right? Because it suggests there's some actual nice amount of what currently constitutes policing in our society, which is contrary to all the scientific evidence about what keeps us safe. But I think you get my point.
You're a wordsmith after my own heart, Eric, Alec. I wanted to I just wanted to help people understand that it's not like the descent of federal agents was like on a blank slate. It was already a militarized, occupied area. In terms of civil rights violations, Alec, like for the unhoused in particular, we've been thinking about, and of course, you know, folks that they identify as immigrants who may or may not be as they're being snatched up off the streets. What kind of things are you seeing and what kind of legal defenses are being mounted?
Well, so I think it's really important to also note that throughout the last couple of decades, at least since the time that I've been a practicing attorney working in these areas, there have been pervasive, utterly rampant, and completely unaccountable violations of people's rights. So, you know, one of the famous cases over the last decade was, you know, the police killing of Philando Castile, who, you know, it turns out had been stopped, you know, 40 or 50 times, I think, something like that, by the police, you know, prior to the fatal encounter in which he was killed by the police. That is the daily life for my clients in the District of Columbia since the time I was a public defender. Just people being stopped day after day after day illegally, people being illegally searched. I did a series of cases, you know, over 10 years ago, where I uncovered sort of a massive fraud in the search warrant practices of DC, where they were engaging in thousands of illegal search warrants of people's homes and brutalizing families. And when the Washington Post replicated my investigation, they found that the illegal and sort of flagrantly illegal home searches in DC that we identified were over 99% focused on Black families. And even that last 1%, they couldn't tell. So it wasn't like, I mean, it was, just, it's almost exclusively focused on certain groups of people in DC. And one of those groups is the unhoused community. And what we're seeing across DC, and it's not just in the last few months, there has been a relentless assault, and you know, not just in Washington, DC, there's been a relentless assault on the unhoused community. And I think one of the reasons this is an important fight for people on all sides is it's sort of a battle over different worldviews and different ways of seeing problems. And so there's a real need to frame from a propaganda perspective the problem of people not having places to live as one of like disorder and criminality, right? When in fact, it's really an economic issue. The vast driver of houselessness in the United States is just pure economics. And the levels of inequality and urban planning choices that we've made have created that problem. And it's not a problem of crime. And it's not a problem that can or ever will be solved by more government bureaucrats with metal chains, handcuffs, guns, tasers, and cages. It's just simply impossible to solve that problem in any kind of reasonable way with police. And yet, every, you know, so often, from time to time, when political circumstances call for it, unhoused people are demonized. They're sort of, they're made into this sort of folk devil in the news. They're people across the political spectrum, from, you know, liberals and centrists and people on the right, you sort of decide that rather than confront this problem of inequality, they'd rather and rather than solve the problem of people not having safe and healthy places to live, they'd rather push those people into places where they either can't be seen or behind closed and locked doors. And that's what we're seeing even more of in Washington, D.C., because the current crackdown is sort of motivated by a desire to show people that something, anything, is being done to quote unquote clean up the city. And so we're seeing massive civil rights violations of people in encampments, of people who don't have a place to live. And it's very similar stuff to what Gavin Newsom is doing in California, for example. Hmm.
All the while positioning himself as the Trump antidote. Anyway, that's a different segment. You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Alec Carcassonis. He's got a book out called Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Injustice System, which we will turn our attention to now. Alec, you say in the introduction of the book, almost nonchalantly, like it caught my attention, and that is, quote, "It is hard to get courts to do what the law requires," end quote. And then you move on, right, to continue to make your point. But for a lot of people, I would dare say most of America, not me so much, or not a lot of black and brown people, of course, but that statement would be a bombshell. And they'd say, well, what do you mean that the courts don't do what the law requires? That's what they're there, is to hold up the law.
Let me say one thing really clearly. And I've been a lawyer since 2008. And I started my career working in the court, and then I was a public defender for many years, and I've been a civil rights lawyer for over a decade since then, and I've studied and worked in the legal systems all across this country. And the defining feature of the criminal punishment bureaucracy in this country is that it does not and cannot enforce even the most basic laws. That is because the legal system that we have, with things like jury trials and due process and things like that, would completely collapse under the sheer volume of cases. The Constitution that we have was not designed for an era of mass incarceration, or mass human caging, as I sometimes call it. It would be impossible to take the 10 million or more people that are arrested every year and give them each a zealous lawyer who investigates their case and files motions and examines whether there were things that happened that were illegal and really investigates the facts of what they're charged with, let alone to impanel 10 million juries, right? It would just completely break. And so the entire apparatus of this assembly line, by the way, it would be impossible to have that many prosecutors and to have that many judges and courtrooms. You know, it would just completely break the system. So the dirty secret that everybody who works in the system knows is that the system will only survive if it figures out a way to get the vast majority of those people to plead guilty, even if they're not guilty, or even if they have defenses that they could, or to dismiss those cases. So everything in the criminal punishment system is a battle of leverage. This is why, for example, prosecutors have been so interested in what are called mandatory minimum sentences. It's not because anybody thinks that longer sentences have any beneficial effect on society. In fact, there's an overwhelming scientific consensus that the longer the sentence does not impact things like deterrence, or it doesn't reduce any of that activity or behavior. It's completely discredited, right? It's one of the most robust findings in all of the criminological history. So nobody thinks that longer sentences. So why do prosecutors pushing for them? Well, it turns out they give prosecutors leverage, right? One way you get somebody to plead guilty, even if they don't think that they did what they're accused of, is you say, well, you know what? If you don't plead guilty and you take your chances, you could get life in prison, mandatory, or 25 years, or 20 years. So I'm just giving you that one example. I could give you 100 examples. But the point is that the system needs to find ways of coercing people into pleading guilty. I'll give you one more example from my work and my book, and something that I'm really passionate about is the money bail system, which is the way that our society determines who is free to go home with their families and who is locked up prior to trial. The United States is one of only two countries in the world, along with the Philippines, that has a for-profit commercial money bail industry. And there's a lot to say about that. But when we challenged that in Houston, Texas, for example, in a case that after we won this landmark constitutional victory, over 100,000 people who would have been jailed have been set free, in misdemeanor cases alone in just the Houston area. That gives you a sense of the scope of these injustices, right? And we've luckily been able to study that with the help of researchers from across the country. And it turns out that just making it so that you're not stuck in jail because you can't pay a few hundred dollars to a private company after you're arrested dramatically reduces future crime. It lets people keep their jobs, stay in school, keep their medications, not lose their housing, et cetera. And that actually stabilizes people's lives and makes them less likely to commit crime in the future. So it's a public safety enhancing change. Prior to our lawsuit, if you were charged with a misdemeanor in Houston and you went to the court and you couldn't pay $100-$200 to a bail bond company, you were likely to plead guilty in 84% of the cases in 3.2 days. So no one was looking at your case. You weren't getting a chance to fight it. You know, you were basically brought to court and said, hey, you know what? If you want to fight your case, you're stuck in jail. But if you want to take a guilty plea, you can get out right away. Just pay us a fine is a way of generating money for the system as well. After we changed that policy and the court found it was unconstitutional to jail someone just because they couldn't pay, most of the people stopped pleading guilty. And to this day, over two-thirds of the cases are dismissed or acquitted. Because when in these minor misdemeanors, when the police and prosecutors are forced to try to prove their cases, they absolutely can't. So that just gives you a sense of like the whole system is not designed to follow the law. And in fact, it's designed for people to be coerced into pleading guilty, even though the Constitution says that no guilty plea is valid unless it's knowing, intelligent, and voluntary. So right there, that's millions of constitutional violations every single year, because nobody who has ever been in these courtrooms thinks that a coerced guilty plea, because they're threatening you with more punishment, is voluntary.
You helped me segue in sort of where I wanted to go next. Data-driven decision-making as it relates to public safety is something I scream about all the time, that the policies and practices do not make anyone any more safe. In fact, they make us less safe. Do participants, because I thought that I read that like some of these participants or a lot of the participants in the criminal legal system just don't know about the data. I often accuse my city council and the police association and everyone else that they know, but they do the opposite of that anyway to maintain the status quo that benefits them, not us.
This is very similar to the situation with global warming. And a lot of people seem to think that you can like do a report on climate change and then bring it to the Exxon executives and board and just show them. And they would say, oh my goodness, you're so right. We didn't realize that our business was actually contributing to this terrible environmental harm. You know what? We're going to just completely change our business model. That's just not how these things work. That's not how capitalism works. It's not how power works. It's certainly not how economics and politics work in contemporary America. And it's very, very similar. The empirical evidence is absolutely overwhelming that more police prosecution and imprisonment does not reduce the levels of interpersonal harm in our society. It's overwhelming. It's like the consensus around climate change. So these people are not uninformed or ignorant. They are in many key respects, but on this issue, they know very well that these policies are not geared toward public safety. They know very well these policies are geared at control and at repression and at preserving distributions of wealth and power, and really using the apparatus of government control and violence against only certain segments of the population, because it's very beneficial and profitable. So if you're a real estate developer who owns certain land in a gentrifying area, it's very important for you to be able to have some control over where police are deployed and which crimes police look for and which crimes police don't, right? If you're a bail bond company or a private equity firm that owns the prison and jail telecom industry, which is a multi-billion-dollar industry, it's very important to you that there that you have in your contracts things like, you know, we demand that the jail be have a certain level of places filled, or that you don't do in-person visits for children because families will spend more money on phone calls if they can't visit each other, right? These are the things that are happening in the system. And so I just think it's nobody that I know who works in the system thinks that like the policies that we have are the result of like the best arguments and that people in power don't know like the truth. I think the problem is one of power, and that's why the solution is not, you know, just, you know, having a meeting with someone on the city council or in the police department or in the mayor's office or the governor's office and convincing them of the right thing to do. The issue is, how do we build enough power to force them to do something that you know, they don't want to do because it goes against the interests of the people who control our political system?
Or we just stop doing the things they tell us to do. I was standing in city council a month or two ago, maybe more. I was doing what I've been doing for 20 years. I'm, you know, screaming at city council. And I had this like out of body experience, Alec, where I was like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And how long, right? And as my mouth kept moving in my head, I was like, how much labor has this cost? How many press releases? How many? I was like, this is nonsensical, right? Because at some point, and I think right now in this political moment in particular, we just got to start doing what we know is better and best for our community. And I think that we've been locked into this rat wheel conversation with the state, expecting it to change or do different. It's not going to, and it's certainly not going to inside of this political moment.
You listen. Not to be too hard on yourself.
Go ahead. No. You go, please.
Well, you know, not to be too hard on yourself. I mean, I think there's real value and I find, you know, what you do very inspiring, because I think it's not just that you're going up there to convince the people that you're talking to. That's not why people testify in front of senators or congresspeople, even though they know that the system is very corrupt. I think you're going up there to kind of hold a beacon out for the truth and to let other people know that there are still people willing to say 2 + 2 = 4, even if everybody else is saying 2 + 2 = 5. And so I think there can be a real role for that kind of work that you do in those local settings, in those city council meetings, and in the fights that you have, you know, on the ground with, like, because you're speaking the truth, and you're speaking the truth as you see it, and you're demonstrating integrity in that, even if, so, I mean, the audience for that may not be the people that you're yelling at or talking to. The audience may be other people. Yeah.
That part is not that we stop speaking the truth. It's who are we speaking the truth to, and what are we doing with that truth, right? Like, what actions are we taking with that truth that actually improve the material conditions of our people? You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. I'm in conversation with Alec Karakassanis. He's got a book out called Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Injustice System. Along those lines, Alec, all of these conversations about criminal justice reform, I mean, reform is the first problem in that phrase. Justice would be the second problem in that phrase, because neither is going to, you know, it isn't that, and that's not, we don't want to reform the injustice that we're dealing with, right? But talk about, from your perspective and what you walk us through a bit in your book, I think this is in the introduction, but the dangerous elements of the current conversations around criminal justice reform. And I think this goes back to what you're talking about before about rule of law, law enforcement, the narrative, and what needs to be fixed.
This is such an important issue. And I, you know, so I wrote this Usual Cruelty book in 2019. And, you know, this theme you're talking about in terms of like the dangers of criminal justice reform and sort of the propaganda around the myth of the rule of law were themes that I became even more obsessed with. And so I address them in sort of different ways, really focusing on the news media in my 2025 book this year, Copaganda. And I should just also say, both books, all the royalties are donated to amazing charities. I don't get any of the royalties. And we also have a free copies of each book, a special paperback edition for anybody in prison. So if you know people in prison, or if you work for a books to prisoner program, you know, we can get you free books. And also for teachers who want to teach the books in their class, but who don't think their students can afford it. So I just wanted to say, like, the idea is to get these ideas out, not to, you know, of course it would be great if you bought a book or several books, and you know, like, that would be very helpful to enable us to keep doing all these free books for people. But they are, we don't ever want money to be a barrier. And I think the reason for that is we're up against tremendously powerful propaganda narratives, like what you just said, like the rule of law, this idea that the ways that laws are written and then enforced in our society are somehow politically neutral, that they don't reinforce the balance of power in a society, both in the decisions about what is even called a crime, and then among the things that are called crimes, which crimes do we even look for as a society? And then from a news media perspective, which people's crimes feature in the nightly news every single night, and which people and institutions' crimes are completely ignored. And I think a deeper point, which is maybe the most important thing that I've ever worked on, is this other part of your question, which is, you know, how are people who recognize the unfairness and injustice of our system co-opted into a project of quote-unquote reforms that don't actually fix the problems that they themselves have identified, but that in fact reinforce the size and power of the punishment bureaucracy? And so for me, you know, there's so many great examples of this. I think police body camera is probably the best example of it. I wrote in my propaganda book a little bit about it, and then I published a separate essay called The Body Camera, The Language of Our Dreams, in the Yale Journal of Law and Liberation last year, where I analyzed 10 years of propaganda about police body cameras. And it's a perfect encapsulation of the principle that the police will always, and not just the police, but prosecutors, prisons, courts, etc., they'll use their own violence and ineffectiveness and corruption as an excuse to get more resources. So the police industry and, you know, the multi-billion dollar surveillance companies, policing companies, and the police institutions themselves, and especially prosecutors, wanted body cameras. They were sort of the holy grail for years, but they couldn't convince governments across the country, many local governments, you know, of which were dominated by liberal Democrats in urban areas. They couldn't convince them to invest the billions of dollars it would need to outfit every police officer in the U.S. with a mobile surveillance camera that the cop controls. And also there was a huge interest in this, and this is probably the bigger factor, in sort of the ongoing billions that could be made from cloud computing contracts, from integration of the body cameras with facial and voice recognition and AI algorithms and sort of big data systems that police started paying huge amounts of money for, companies like Amazon and Microsoft and Axon, et cetera. So they also wanted, you know, to be able to go to, I think, some protests or go to a poor neighborhood and just scan the crowd and then have those images sort of recorded, and then using facial recognition sort of tell who is here, who knows each other, who is organizing this protest, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, prosecutors wanted to have evidence that would enable them to more quickly coerce guilty pleas. And they knew that the body camera stuff would be used almost exclusively against the poorest people in our society, like unhoused people for trespassing or drug possession, et cetera, and almost never, ever, ever used against the police, both because the police control when the cameras are on and off. They look outward away from the police officer, so you can train officers to use the cameras in certain ways. And also a big benefit for them was they could control the virality of certain events. So they could be taking so much video of all of us, and whenever they wanted to, they could release a video immediately, like, let's say, to stoke fear about an undocumented immigrant who's committed a crime or something like that. But whenever they don't want it, like, let's say the police murder of Laquan McDonald, the teenager in Chicago, they could just hide the video for years or maybe forever. So I think this is I just give this example, after Michael Brown's killing in Ferguson, they actually pivoted and reoriented their strategy to say, oh no, we don't want these body cameras for police purposes because it'll help us coerce quick guilty pleas and deal with the assembly line and surveil people and protect us because we control when they're on and off and allow us to dominate the propaganda narrative and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We want them for accountability and transparency. And using that new framing, particularly because it was picked up by Barack Obama and a bunch of liberal Democratic officials, they completely changed the course of history, and they were able to get the largest expansion of police surveillance technology in modern history using their own violence as the excuse. So what used to be this thing that police desperately wanted, and by the way, they wanted them so badly before Michael Brown was killed that people like Steven Spielberg were donating privately to police foundations to get them for cops, like in Los Angeles. And so
what?
Yeah, isn't that wild? That's how badly police wanted them. And then it was framed, and every article 10 years afterward, even the articles that pointed out the actual scientific evidence, which is that body cameras do not make the police any less violent, they do not actually result in any police accountability in the aggregate, empirically, in terms of the data, okay? Even those articles that point that out frame it as some kind of good faith attempt at accountability and transparency, which it completely erases the whole point of the body cameras from the perspective of the policing industry. And that's a good example of what I talk about in the book in terms of like almost every major reform in the criminal punishment system over the last 70 years has actually increased the size and power of the punishment bureaucracy and not made it more accountable or transparent.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I am your host, Kat Brooks. We're in conversation with Alec Karakassanis. We're talking about his book, Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Injustice System. So I interviewed James Forman Jr. a few years back when he released his book, Locking Up Our Own. And it was in that interview, the cool part about my job is I get to learn every day, all the time, where I first really understood the power of the prosecutor. How much discretion they have, how I believe in that book, or at least in the interview, James Forman asserted to me that like it is actually inside of that role where actual criminal legal system transformation could occur if they just started to behave differently. Can you talk about prosecutorial discretion, the power that prosecutors have? And I don't know, maybe this is just me being Kat Brooks, smart aleck. But I was like, in what training does one receive to qualify you to decide the fate of the entirety of another human being's life?
My view is essentially the following. I have a lot to say about prosecutors, and you know, folks can read the books and you know, see some of my other writing about this. But it's essentially that prosecutors have developed so much power in our society, and many people over the last 10 years, not me, but many other people, concluded that they were a very promising avenue of reform because they had so much power. And if you could just convince them to use their power in different ways, different choices, like let's say instead of charging people for marijuana possession, they could investigate all of the untested rape kits, or they could prosecute people for white collar crime, tax evasion, and wage theft, and all the millions of pollution crimes that aren't prosecuted. So, or various other things, right? I should just, as a side note, police and prosecutors in this country for decades chose to prosecute more marijuana possession offenses than all violent crime combined. So I think there are some ways in which prosecutors can be a lot less cruel, and changing prosecutorial policies in some cities can have a meaningful effect on levels of incarceration and family separation, I don't want to minimize that. Like, I do think, for example, the difference between what Larry Krasner has done in Philadelphia and what a different prosecutor would do or what his predecessors did is really meaningful, right? So I'm not rejecting the idea of having people in power who are prosecutors who, you know, are less cruel and less focused on, you know, completely disproven forms of punishment. I think same in Oakland and San Francisco, you know, it mattered a lot that there was someone in office who, you know, can be less punitive. It's better. But I think it's overstated. And the reason I think it's overstated is that prosecutors only have this much power precisely because they have been using it to crush the most powerless and vulnerable people in our society. I told a few of the elected prosecutors over the years, and I won't say who, you know, everyone's telling you you're so powerful, but if you announced tomorrow that there were all these vacant third and fourth homes by really wealthy people in your city, and you're just not going to enforce trespassing laws for anyone who doesn't have a place to live or stay if they want to go and walk into one of these extra vacant homes, you would be impeached immediately. You'd be recalled. Even though that's exactly what prosecutors do for most other crimes. Like, we're just not going to enforce these wage theft laws, you know? Prosecutors are always deciding which laws to enforce. But the moment you start to say, oh, we're going to start enforcing these laws against powerful corporations or the wealthiest people in our society, we're going to start trying to prosecute the police, for example, which is, you know, one of the things that led to the recall of you know, prominent DAs, you know, commitment to start prosecuting the police, which then led to huge political campaigns by the police, you actually wouldn't have very much power at all. The power is limited. The power is sort of exists in the office, and it doesn't exist in the person. And to the extent the person tried to deviate from what the office function really is in a very unequal society, the person would be seen to have little power. And that's sort of my main thought on the kind of progressive prosecutors.
Thank you for helping us hold the complexity of this conversation. You all have been listening to Law & Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Burks. We've been in conversation with Alec Karakassanis, a civil rights lawyer and the founder of Civil Rights Corps, an organization challenging systemic injustices in the legal system. The organization's work has freed hundreds of thousands of people from illegal jailing and reunited hundreds of thousands of families. He was named the 2016 Trial Lawyer of the Year by Public Justice for designing and litigating constitutional challenges to cash bail in modern debtors' prisons across the United States. He lives in Washington, D.C. His book that we've been discussing today is Usual Cruelty, The Complicity of Lawyers in the Criminal Justice System. Thank you, Alec.
Thank you, Kat.
You've been listening to Law & Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law & Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.